what felt like the furthest reaches of North America, culling and collating material in the world-class Scientology archive assembled by Stephen Kent, a sociology professor at the University of Alberta. I was there to research an epic battle between geeks and the Church of Scientology that began in the early 1990s and spanned two decades, starting after the Church of Scientology targeted its critics, especially those who leaked secret scripture. Humorously dubbed Internet versus Scientology, the battle was waged both offline and online between netizens, wholly committed to free speech, and the Church of Scientology, wholly committed to stamping it out by using any means necessary, legal or illegal, to censor criticism and prevent leaked documents from circulating online. I had arrived with a cultural hypothesis. Hackers and Scientology stand in a diametrically opposed relationship to each other. This is not only because they are different, but because they are so precisely different. They are mirror images of each other, the perfect foils. Consider the central doctrine espoused by Keeping Scientology Working, a publication of the Church's Religious Technology Center. The prose functions like a rusted first-generation robot that is lurched into a corner and, finding itself unable to turn around, continues plodding forward while monotonously droning, 1. Having the correct technology, 2. Knowing the technology, 3. Knowing it is correct, 4. Teaching correctly the correct technology, 5. Applying the technology, 6. Seeing that the technology is correctly applied, 7. Hammering out the existence of incorrect technology, 8. Knocking out incorrect applications, 9. Closing the door on any possibility of incorrect technology, 10. Closing the door on incorrect application. Reading these maxims in 2007, I knew that any hacker or geek who laid eyes on them would be simultaneously entertained and offended. Where Scientology is shrouded in secrecy, steeped in dogma, and dependent on the deployment of pseudo-science and faux technology to control people, hacking lives in the light of inquisitive tinkering, and exploration enables, and is enabled by, science and technology. Hackers dedicate their lives and pour their souls into creating and programming the world's most sophisticated machines. They are quintessential craftsmen, motivated by a desire for excellence, but they abhor the idea of a single correct technology. In fact, hacking is where craft and craftiness intermingle. Make a 3D printer that prints a 3D printer. Assemble an army of zombie computers into a botnet, and then steal another hacker's botnet to make yours more powerful. Design a robot solely for the purposes of mixing cocktails and showcase it at Robo Exotica, a festival for cocktail robotics held since 1999. Invent a programming language called Brainfuck, designed to, well, mess with the heads of anyone who tries to program with it. You get the picture. A religion which claims a privileged access to science and technology, to the extent of declaring themselves the only group on Earth that has a workable technology which handles the basic rules of life itself and brings order out of chaos, is deeply offensive to hackers whose only demand on technology is that it should, at minimum, actually do something, a task they leave not to some transcendent discovery of truth, but instead to their personal ingenuity in discovering solutions to technical problems, with the help of shared tips, swapped ideas, and reams of borrowed code. So it made a lot of sense that Anonymous, composed of geeks and hackers, would rise against Scientology. But something was unclear. Was Anonymous simply trolling for its own lulzy amusement? Or was it earnestly protesting? Even if I was pretty certain these were not deliberate acts of activism, a political spirit was clearly wafting through IRC. People were undeniably and royally pissed off that Scientology dared to censor a video on their internet, especially such a hilarious one. Anons were phone-pranking the Dianetics hotline and sending scores of unpaid pizza to church centers, sharing their exploits in real time across 4chan. At first, any political aim seemed incidental. And then weeks later, one particular act of ultra-coordinated motherfuckery gave way to an earnest, though still undoubtedly irreverent, activist endeavor. As Chanology grew in popularity, its bustling IRC channels, Pound Xenu and Pound Target, became unsuitable working environments for the publicity stunts and outreach to which it aspired. Three people broke away and started IRC channel Pound Press. Soon after, it grew to include eight members who worked one evening until daybreak to create what still qualifies as Anonymous's best-known work of art. Eventually, the team grew in size, Pound Press became chaotic, and members split off yet again. They called themselves Marble Cake, after one of their own found inspiration in the baked item he was eating. If the Tom Cruise video struck a chord both humorous and hyperbolic, this team harmonized to create an ironic video whose tone embodied a trickster-like ambiguity, simultaneously hilarious and serious, playful and ominous. Much to everyone's surprise, the video catapulted Anonymous onto a new plane of existence. In the video, a drab corporate glass building stands against a backdrop of ominously racing dark clouds. A speech begins, which, while delivered by a robotic voice, is poetic and inspirational. "For the good of your followers, for the good of mankind, and for our own enjoyment, we shall proceed to expel you from the Internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form. We recognize you as a serious opponent and do not expect our campaign to be completed in a short time frame. However, you will not prevail forever against the angry masses of the body politic. Your choice of methods, your hypocrisy, and the general lawlessness of your organization have sounded its death knell. You have nowhere to hide because we are everywhere. You have no recourse in attack because for each of us that falls, 10 more will take his place. We are cognizant of the many who may decry our methods as parallel to those of the Church of Scientology, those who espouse the obvious truth that your organization will use the actions of Anonymous as an example of the persecution of which you have for so long warned your followers. This is acceptable to Anonymous. In fact, it is encouraged." It was earnest, but earnestly a joke. This poetic imagery of a rising up was rhetoric, but it was so compelling, so enticing as a lulzy direction, that it entrapped the Anonymous trolls into a commitment to the systematic dismantling of Scientology. They got caught up, like so many tricksters before them, in their own trickster trap. Anonymous, in its sudden commitment to a lulzy politics, gave birth to the reviled moral fags and leader fags. These Anons, tainted somehow by an accidental taste for justice, effectively catalyzed one of the most potent protest movements of our times. The accidental train of events went like this. The video unexpectedly sparked a debate as to whether Anons should hit the streets to protest the church or remain faithful to their madcap roots in raids and lulls. The timing helped make the decision for them, tipping things in favor of street demonstrations. Greg Hoosh, one of the video's editors and an original member of Marble Cake, explained it as follows during an interview. "There were people who didn't think Anonymous or 4chan should take to the streets, but the consensus to actually do it came relatively easily for us after the video. It seemed to be great timing, the right video at the right moment." Even if Anons were leaning toward protest, they did not want to ditch trolling completely. Rather, they wanted to expand their repertoire. One Anon on IRC captured the full spectrum: legal, illegal, lulzy, serious, that these hordes of trolls were increasingly inhabiting, or wanting to inhabit, between mid-January 2008 and the first street protest. Her pseudonym has been changed. Lulamania. The ultimate scenario: Anonymous prank call plus DDoS, U.S. and French government renew fraud charges, tax evasions and illegal activities charges, local church pastors telling their congregation the evils of Scientology, former members and families interviewed on TV about experience, activist groups holding licensed rallies and protests, and the news covering all of the above. Keep in mind, this is a war of attrition. We cannot bankrupt Scientology directly. This is about getting media attention, informing the public, wearing down their members, pissing off their IT phone services, counter-brainwashing their potential recruits, and for the lulz. On January 24th, 2008, Anonymous announced that February 10th would be a day of protest. A few days after this initial call to action, Scientology critic Mark Bunker seized the high-octane moment to push for the use of legal tactics alone. Like the trickster of communication and crossroads, Ishu, he reached out to the trolls in a video, Holy Xenu, praised them, smart, and asked them to join the cause, Holy Xenu. His message was to simmer the hell down, rein in the lulls, and please, please refrain from anything straight up illegal. On a lengthy post to a forum on whyweprotest.net, Bunker explained what motivated him to make the video. After seeing Anonymous's message to Scientology, I was worried that I had helped to spawn attacks that would potentially scare Scientology staffers and also get Anonymous members in legal trouble, so I decided I needed to make my initial tape to Anonymous. Although many had already been thinking along these lines, not everyone was on board with the vision offered by this hefty, bear-like man in his 50s, whom Anonymous renamed Wise Beard Man for his erudite posturing and white facial hair. Only a few years later, new activist networks would arise that embraced militant, illegal digital tactics like the DDoS, not for trolling, but for political dissent. Nevertheless, enough of them shifted gears and darted down the path of activism. Bunker's arguments nudged Anonymous toward the use of mostly legal tactics for its first major demonstrations. The Cake of Marble, beavering away, largely in secret, a cohort of outsiders knew of its existence, was aware that the great majority of potential participants were likely protest neophytes. If these internet nerds, geeks, hackers, and trolls showed up en masse to protest without any prior activist experience, it would almost certainly be a recipe for ruin. So they had to get them up to speed, and rather quickly. They delivered a crash course on the mechanics, challenges, and components of peaceful protest in a video called Code of Conduct. Posted on February 1st, 2008, a robotic voice lists 22 rules. No detail is overlooked. The video reminds participants to wear comfortable shoes, drink plenty of water, keep particularly geeky and objectionable internet jokes to themselves, because these would likely offend bystanders, refrain from any violence, obtain necessary permits, use catchy slogans, and record the event. Since Marble Cake knew that Scientologists would use all available means, including high-definition photos, to identify and subsequently harass protesters, one rule exhorted participants to cover their faces, but noted, in a statement that now appears ironic, that there was no need to use masks. Rule number 17, cover your face. This will prevent your identification from videos taken by hostels, other protesters, or security. Use scarves, hats, and sunglasses. Masks are not necessary, and donning them in the context of a public demonstration is forbidden in some jurisdictions. Necessary or not, as thousands of Anons and supporters hit the streets in cities around the world, masks appeared everywhere. By then, the Guy Fawkes mask was a pop cultural icon, thanks to the Hollywood blockbuster V for Vendetta. The movie portrays a lone anarchist's fight against a dystopian Orwellian state. The mask had also appeared previously on 4chan, worn by a beloved meme character with a penchant for failure, Epic Fail Guy. Well-known, easy to purchase, and imbued with an undeniable symbolic energy, both on account of its history and its more recent iteration, the Guy Fawkes mask became the mask du jour to deter the prying eyes of Scientology. After, it would function as Anonymous's signature icon. The day's events straddled the line between serious political protest and carnivalesque shenanigans. Why did so many people show up? During an informal chat, one longtime Anon and member of Marble Cake reasoned to me, correctly, I think, that hearing about the first reports of East Australian protests on February 10, 2008, really set things in motion. Had those not materialized, I figure the turnout elsewhere wouldn't have been as important. While much of the Western world slumbered, in Australia, an estimated 550 to 850 protesters poured into the streets, conveying their numbers in real time to others in video clips and photos, setting off a domino effect felt across much of the Western world. In London, the crowd swelled to 600, and this success was matched in North America, where protesters hit the streets in small cities across the heartland and in major metropolitan centers like Los Angeles, where a whopping 1,000 people turned out. 6 months after a local Fox News station labeled Anonymous the Internet hate machine, they had legions of followers in the streets, not just geeks and hackers hammering at their keyboards, who were seizing on the group's name, its ethic of anonymity, and assorted concomitant iconography. That evening, men and women in Guy Fawkes masks and black suits with signs announcing "We are the Internet" could be seen on cable news shows around the world. While this may have been the first time Anons demonstrated in large numbers in the streets, previous trolling campaigns had a quasi-activist flair. For instance, in 2007, Anonymous targeted right-wing radio personality Hal Turner, not only for lulz and revenge, but also because he was a racist. Anonymous had first targeted him in 2006 with a series of prank phone calls and computer attacks that took down his website. Hal Turner countered by publishing the numbers of the prank callers, prompting Anonymous to hit hard at the heart of his radio empire, trolling and hacking the heck out of him. The following blog post, published by an Anonymous participant before the second round of raids, conveys the undeniable political sensibility compelling the action. Those of you who spend any time around the troll pits of the internet, such as 4chan, 7chan, YTMND, etc., will undoubtedly know of this already, but it's worth repeating. Hal Turner is, in short, a Nazi. A Nazi with his own radio show. Unfortunately for him, he also hasn't really got a mass following, except from the beatards and other various trolls who decided to absolutely ruin his life online. As the Fox News below clip of him advocating the murder of a U.S. judge shows, he isn't exactly someone to feel sorry for. Chanology differed from those previous raids in one crucial respect. It became a permanent fixture in the political landscape. In the weeks and months following the first street demonstrations, Chanology continued to protest Scientology's relentless legal and extra-legal crackdown on critics and on those who dared to disclose or circulate internal documents. As one protester explained to me during a street demonstration in Ireland, "Came for the lulz, stayed for the great justice, epic win, and more lulz." But why? How did such a chaotic ensemble organize themselves? And could the lulz still thrive when seeking justice? Why and how we protest. Every time I reflect on the constitution and perseverance of Chanology, it strikes me as a minor miracle in the annals of political resistance. To be sure, a subset of trolling, like the Hal Turner raids, struck a political chord, but the energy behind these early raids tended to dissipate after a few days or weeks. Chanology was sustained in an environment not exactly conducive to long-term deliberate political organizing. It behooves us to consider the social dynamics between Chanology's success, especially in light of the many tensions. For instance, between lulz-driven action and moral goals, which bedeviled it from the start. To begin with, the formation of a sustained political will was secured by the widespread media coverage of the February street demonstrations. From the first day, people in Guy Fawkes masks were all over the news. Hundreds of photos and dozens of homemade videos from local protests were shared through IRC and popular social media sites like Digg, MySpace, Yahoo Groups, and LiveJournal. For many Anons, the external representations validated Project Chanology and Anonymous. This dynamic of success and amplification repeated many times in the organization's history. Also significant were ulterior motives. While activism was a significant factor for many Anons, and the lulz were always enticing, many turned out for the rare opportunity to meet some of their Anonymous brethren. Some stayed, others returned to their dark corners of the internet and contested this incipient political sensibility, sometimes deriding their peers as moral fags and redoubling their trolling, even targeting Chanology itself as a source of lols. Take, for instance, the following proposal: a call to reclaim Anonymous from the moral fags in order to resurrect the internet hate machine, proposed on Chanology's very active virtual town square, the web forum enturbulation.org, which was eventually ported to Why We Protest. Fellow brothers and sisters, 6 months ago we started on a jihad to ensure that our internets would be free of faggotry. A call to arms went out, and we answered it as Legion. Today, when looking back at our naive efforts, it is obvious that what is ours by right has been stolen from us. Our name, our memes, and our efforts have been hijacked by people who do not understand and do not realize that our strength came from being diverse, uncaring, and unrelenting. While normally this would not be an issue, those who have stayed in the trenches protecting our ideals are now at an impasse. We need your help. I am bent on hand and foot asking that those that have left Project Chanology return and reclaim it. Bring back the lulls. Bring back the hate machine. Do not let some rather forceful detractors sway you. We started this to ensure our internets were free from tyranny, and while I agree there are fights ahead that may be more important to this end, this is the first one, where we mold the new fags into hardened trolls and ensure that when the man comes to claim what is rightfully free, we are all well-versed in ensuring that cannot happen. Over the coming weeks, you will see some old faces raid your channels, your boards, your IRCs, to ensure that Anonymous retains what is ours. Reclaim Chanology once and for all. Burn anything that opposes us to the ground. The binary between moral fags and hardened lulls seekers was, and still is, less clear-cut than this post suggests. On the IRC channels dedicated to political organizing, a small but rather vocal minority offered technical aid for political gain, while also insisting on lulzy action, including horrific forms of trolling. Among these trolls, a single individual named CPU, not his real name, stood out. Widely considered a talented hacker, he freely offered technical advice. But he was also a fierce critic of the moral fags and would clamor for vicious forms of trolling. For instance, on March 16, 2008, CPU suggested the following on the IRC channel Pound Internet Hate Machine, a chat room for criticizing the moral fags. All names have been changed. CPU: Internet Hate Machine is for those sick of the moral fags and the love fags, am I right, LOL? We should just hit a random forum for the lulls. Anyone remember the emetophobia raids? I'm searching for a forum, LOL. Oh, LOL, suicideforum.com. First person to push someone to the edge wins? Who remembers Happy Tree Friends? We trashed the forums every day for about 2 weeks, LOL. Emo Corner got owned in the end. Hard, but it took time. Too many people attacking the same thing at once, LOL. We took their forum off of them at least twice and added a deface page, LOL. Or we could find an epilepsy forum and spam it with flashing GIFs or something? XB: epilepsyforum.org.uk. CPU: go, 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 go. Co: oh god, PHP bulletin board as well? Oh, so exploitable. CPU: change main page to one big flashing thing? LOL, making an account now. If we can change the main page, we use this: freetheflash.com/flash/epilepsy-test.php. Whether CPU and the others on the channel went on to execute this campaign is unknown, but someone did. On March 22, 2012, trolls engaged in one of the most morally reprehensible and notorious attacks to date, invading an epilepsy forum and posting bright flashing images, which induced seizures among some of the forum's members. Nearly every piece of reporting incorrectly attributed the attack to Anon's fighting Scientology, which was not likely the case. Various threads on different image boards blamed another notorious board infested with trolls, E-Bombs World. Even if Chanology was not behind the attack, the raid left a dark stain on the name Anonymous, infuriating some members of Chanology. It must be noted that while the anti-Scientology crusaders were mortified by the Epilepsy Forum attack, these nascent moral fags did not altogether disavow deviance or the lulz. It is, after all, part of the fabric of their culture. Instead, Chanology dabbled in a kinder, gentler breed of lulz. For instance, New York City is home to an annual, and rather sizable, zombie flash mob, whereupon 1,000 ghoulish, bloody, slow-moving, groaning bodies drag, or sometimes roller skate, themselves through the city streets. Chanology organizers in New York thought it might be lulzy if this zombie mob paraded in front of the Scientology church on the day of Anonymous's monthly protest there. The zombie mob happily obliged. They sauntered down 46th Street in slow motion, yelling obscenities at the church, while the Chanology protesters ruffled and snickered at Scientology, obviously proud of the theatrical and mostly G-rated lulz they managed to stage. But there is no better example of activist Anon's engagement of carnivalesque humor than Operation Slick Pubes in January 2009, also orchestrated by the Chanology cell in New York. It consisted of a nearly naked person. He was partially covered by a veneer of smeared Vaseline and pubic hair, streaking through a Scientology org. The aim of this over-the-top endeavor was not simply to antagonize and anger church members through an act of defilement, though this was no doubt part of it, but also to revitalize what some participants saw as the flagging spirit of the lulz. The forces of Apollo had to be balanced, eternally, with a bit of Dionysian trickster revelry. Later, Chanology members wrote about the incident in a blog post on motherfuckery.org, a site designed to commemorate their roots. What resulted in the following months could only be described as lulz and you mad, as the record of the Slick Pubes operation made its round through the world of Chanology, Anonymous, and the higher ranks of Scientology. Those who thought Chanology was too tame rejoiced. Within this emerging politically oriented Anonymous, the lulz were often deployed, as in Operation Slick Pubes, in a jocular Dionysian form, risque, yet also risky. They worked by simultaneously making one laugh, making one cringe, and also offering a politics of subversion, but not without consequences. Indeed, in the case of Operation Slick Pubes, the greasy streaker was arrested for his antics. The incident also prompted the NYPD to begin secretly monitoring Anonymous, a necessary baptism for any new political group, and what better way to attract law enforcement than through pubic hair? Wisebeard Man may have tamed the Anonymous trickster, but he did not fully eliminate its mischievous spirit. Anonymous's willingness to wreak havoc in pursuit of lulz and free speech, and in opposition to the malfeasance and deception of Scientology, calls to mind the 19th century European social bandits described by historian Eric Hobsbawm in his 1959 book Primitive Rebels. These bandits are members of mafias, secret societies, religious sects, urban mobs, and outlaw gangs. They are ultimately thugs, but according to Hobsbawm, they nurture a faint revolutionary spirit. Some of their plunder is typically redistributed to the poor, who they further protect from bandits other than themselves. Hobsbawm defines the bandits as pre-political figures who have not yet found, or only begun to find, a specific language in which to express their aspirations about the world. Anonymous has worked toward finding that language with remarkable celerity since it launched Project Chanology. Such hijinks nevertheless contrast with Hobsbawm's moral narrative, whereby bandits can only become viable political actors by giving up their menacing tactics and buying into conventional forms of power. For Hobsbawm, the bandit is pitted against the forces of the new society which he cannot understand. At most, he can fight it and seek to destroy it. This explains why the bandit is often destructive and savage beyond the range of his myth. Today's digital bandits, however, understand the forces of creative destruction, consciously deploying them for political purposes. The lulz retained a prominent seat, but not at the head of the table. Chanology was a far cry from a chaotic horde of loons. While working in the midst of an often miasmic environment of drama, infighting, and competing groups, Chanology members developed a strong organization, with core participants devoting extraordinary chunks of time to the endeavor. We can take, as a case study, the software behind the immensely popular web forum Why We Protest, largely written by a young French geek named Ravel. He described joining Chanology as a natural fit, given that he had some mischievous years and strong affinities with both the hacker and freedom of speech cultures. When the call to action came, I didn't bat an eye and pretty much uttered, "Let's do this." He made it his life project for the next 6 years and counting. The project emerged from the creation of the Pound website IRC channel. Ravel, known as Sue, disliked the existing proposals and, in classic hacker style, started to code the software according to his own vision with the help of two other programmers. Due to his hard work, he was tapped to become part of Marblecake. I was approached and became part of the unduly infamous Marblecake Collective. To date, it has been the most organized group I have collaborated with online. I wouldn't exaggerate when saying the quorum of participants spent over 70 hours a week working on media projects, planning, PR, and brainstorming. It served both as think tank and production studio. Meetings were held near daily, assessments were made, notes kept, and so forth. What the dicks is Marblecake? First challenges to the new anonymous. With a sizable portion of Anons now firmly committed to this politically engaged style of hacking, complete with a technical infrastructure of channels, monthly meetups at Chanology events, and an emergent range of memes and objects specific to Activist Anonymous, like Guy Fawkes masks, it was only a matter of time before this identity would fracture. Homeostasis is not exactly the preferred state of Anonymous, certainly not before Chanology, and definitely not after. Let's linger for a moment on Ravel's characterization of Marblecake as the most organized group I have collaborated with online. By all accounts, Marblecake was extremely effective in creating propaganda, issuing press releases, brokering between city cells, and suggesting themes for monthly protests. Among other factors, many attributed its success to a skilled organizer who went by the name of Dar. A peer described her to me as resolute and fierce, kind and understanding, qualities the Anon thought crucial to Marblecake's accomplishments. But then Dar made the mistake of attempting to push through an unpopular proposal. For the May 2008 protest, Marblecake suggested the theme Operation Psych Out to air Scientology's human rights abuses in the field of psychiatry, which was met with a lot of opposition, explained one active member to me. Soon after, Marblecake hammered the final nail into its own coffin, at least in the form it existed at the time, by seeking to railroad it through, which led to Chanology members taking Dar down, who was seen as a particularly vocal proponent, or a power-hungry wannabe leader fag, as one Anon put it. Trolls especially went for the jugular, doxing her and spreading lies. She quit the project, never to be seen again. Marblecake existed in a nebulous zone. When the eight members had splintered off in January 2008, they left a permanent notification on the chat channel Pound Press. Want access to where all the action is? Get your ass on SSL and don't be a faggot. D. Topic set by Dar on February 16, 2008. Those intrigued by this enticing message could ask an old fag about it, someone around since the beginning, and be directed through the steps to set up encryption, SSL. They would also have to be prepared to clock a lot of long hours. In this way, Marblecake grew to include 25 participants. Eventually, the topic message was replaced and growth stagnated. Newcomers had no idea about its existence. 3 months after Dar's outing, someone posted a message on Why We Protest. What the dicks is Marblecake? The answer they received effectively informed a much larger swath of Anons about the semi-secret project. For many, it revealed for the first time that multiple factions had developed under the mantle of Chanology. I'm in Marblecake, and I've no interest in being a leader fag. I'm happy to answer questions. The short story is, it is slash was a small think tank that produced media anonymously and secretly. The positive spin would be that it has suffered from its own success. It produces enough significant media that it desires to remain completely secret, and producing enough media that the rest of Anonymous became aware, to varying degrees, that there is a secret cabal of Anons trying to manipulate things behind the scenes. The negative spin is that it's a secret cabal of Anons trying to manipulate things behind the scenes. And there is a case to be made that they got a swelled head early. They produced the original Message to Scientology video well before I got involved. They were also led by Dar, who pissed off the wrong people, has the wrong attitude, and generally didn't handle criticism well. As far as factions go, there's Marble Cake and Turb Mods, OCMB, and the Pound and Turbulation Channers, in addition to each individual city's cell and probably many others I don't know about. MC and Entube Mods have battled. Pound and Turbulation, specifically Tuesday and WB, have battled with Marble Cake. OCMB often has drama pour over into Enturbulation. Pound in Turbulation generally hates Marble Cake. It's all a bunch of stupid infighting, and many people have been involved with more than one of those groups. And nobody should feel left out for not being involved in any of them, because they're all essentially janitors for the real Anons, the ones that are out in cities flyering and picketing. The ensuing thread was long and bitter. Some people were seething, including some members and ex-members of the Cabal. After this brouhaha, Marble Cake foundered for a bit before undergoing what one Anon called reformation. Afterwards, they functioned with more transparency regarding their role as choreographers, to borrow the phrase used by Paolo Gerbado, to describe a leadership style common throughout the global protest movements of 2011. Marble Cake's outing showed that a simple binary between leaders and followers failed to capture the complex organizational dynamics in a milieu so committed to decentralization. Anonymous is not a united front, but a hydra, comprising numerous different networks. Even within a single project, there are working groups that are often at odds with one another, not to mention the civil wars between different nodes of Anonymous more generally. But even if Anons don't always agree about what is being done under the auspices of Anonymous, they tend to respect the fact that anyone can assume the moniker. The mask, which has become its signature icon, functions as an eternal beacon, broadcasting the symbolic value of equality, even in the face of bitter divisions and inequalities. Of course, despite the lack of a stable hierarchy or a single point of control, some Anons are more active and influential than others, at least for limited periods. Anonymous abides by a particular strain of what geeks call duocracy, with motivated individuals, or those with free time, extending its networked architecture by contributing time, labor, and attention to existing endeavors, or leaving others to start ones of their own, aligned better to their ideals and principles. Whether a movement even fesses up to the existence of soft leaders is an important question. It relates to another issue plaguing many social movements. How does a social movement maintain enough permeability that newcomers can join pre-existing groups whose tendency is to become cliquish? Without overt recognition that leadership exists, a project can fall easily into the tyranny of structurelessness, a situation whereby the vocalizing of an ideology of decentralization works as a platitude that obscures or redirects attention away from firmly entrenched but hidden nodes of power behind the scenes. Following the heated controversy that erupted on Why We Protest, many Anons came to accept that Marble Cake played a valuable organizational role. The group's soft leadership engendered an impressive amount of organization, both online and in local cities. But the general consensus was in favor of more transparency. There is no way Scientology can win on us anymore. It is over. In 2014, Project Chanology is a shadow of its former self. Current monthly protests draw only the hardcore, with small to mid-sized turnouts in a smattering of cities, like Dublin, Dusseldorf, Hamburg, and New York. However, this situation reflects not failure, but success. While Project Chanology did not demolish the church, it altered the game so fundamentally that critics could now stand confidently under the sun without fear of reprisal. The church no longer had the upper hand. This point was driven home by numerous ex-Scientologists during a conference I attended called Dublin Offlines, organized by ex-Scientologists on June 30th, 2012. It had been a little over 4 years since this unlikely elixir first fomented via a strange brew of ex-church members, Scientology critics, and uppity internet geeks. This occasion seemed an appropriate time and place for me to take stock of the project's historical import. The conference was held in Dublin's Teachers Club, aka Club Na Muntori, housed in a four-story Georgian building which provided cozy and intimate shelter from the ever-present Irish drizzle. About 70 folks attended, a sizable chunk of them wearing Guy Fawkes masks. In keeping with the theatrics common to street demonstrations, some anons from France were dressed with panache in circus and pantomime get-ups. Two were even dressed as giant leprechauns. My personal favorite was the guy sporting a cow suit. Speakers included ex-Scientologists from the Scientology ship, some from the Sea Org, Jerry Armstrong, the former personal secretary to L. Ron Hubbard, Jamie DeWolf, the great-grandson of L. Ron Hubbard, a couple of academics, including myself, and a handful of individuals who had lost family to the church. The master of ceremonies was Pete Griffiths, a local and a former executive director of the Kendal Mission in Cumbria, England. His shimmering silver suit perfectly matched his spirited personality. Since I was staying on the other side of town, I arrived a little late to find the talks already in full swing. I tiptoed in, silently waved to some of the locals I knew from a previous trip to Dublin, and slipped into a seat. I felt okay, if certainly under-caffeinated. But by the end of the day, having squirmed in discomfort during many of the talks, I was left emotionally drained. The ex-Scientologists provided moving personal accounts of the cult's power to strangle the lives of both those in the church and those who dared to leave. Church policy mandates that new recruits sever ties with any family and friends who object, as many do. Leaving the organization is often a logistical nightmare, since one's personal network has been so thoroughly eviscerated. If a member is public about his or her exit, the member is targeted under the Fair Game Policy, which states that the individual may be deprived of property or injured by any means by any Scientologist without any discipline of the Scientologist, may be tricked, sued, or lied to, or destroyed. A talk by Tori Christman stood out among the rest. Before leaving on July 20th, 2000, she had been a Scientologist for 31 years, during which period she honed her speaking skills by performing public relations for the church. Christman was confident, eloquent, inspirational, and witty. Sporting rectangular glasses and a bright blue suit, she beamed with energy. She spoke for 30 minutes and packed in a whole lot. Her entry into the church, some of her less than pleasant experiences, such as the church's attempt to discourage her use of epilepsy medicine, insight into the church's mechanics of brainwashing. It is a slow train of mind control, as she put it, and descriptions of the church's theological tendencies delivered through pricey classes. Keeping Scientology working is on every single course. As she was winding down, she described her harrowing escape. Scientology chased me across the country and highlighted the church's greatest irony. They are selling freedom, but they enslave you. She also duly acknowledged Anonymous's role. Everyone now has the luxury of being public because A, the internet, B, critics even before Anonymous, and C, Anonymous, right? Which was totally a game changer, forever. And it was, and we all know this. She highlighted the bravery of an earlier generation of critics, a handful of whom were in attendance, who acted publicly when the number of defectors was low and Scientology held the power to shatter their lives by targeting critics aggressively and with impunity. Anonymous would not be around if it were not for the critics before them, she said. Her next statement reverberated in slow motion through the room and touched everyone personally. There is no way Scientology can win on us anymore. It is over. For the ex-Scientologists in the room, the words likely hit as a combination of relief and joy. The Anons, some of whom had become close to ex-Scientologists, likely felt the pride of political accomplishment wash over them. There is nothing, nothing quite like the sweet taste of political victory. And Chanology had accomplished the unlikely. The group successfully challenged an organization that seemed all-powerful, impervious to critique, and above the law. More remarkable yet is that what started as a narrowly configured politics launched against a single foe broke out of that frame to encompass a fuller, diverse, thoroughly global political enterprise, a bonfire that burned hot and bright enough to spread across the globe, becoming anonymous everywhere. Let's now turn to the unlikely events that propelled Anonymous's surprising rise to prominence. Chapter 3. Weapons of the Geek. WikiLeaks, the gift that keeps on giving. It was July 2010, and I was attending a conference called Hackers on Planet Earth, also known as HOPE, held every other year in New York City's charmingly historic and, in its resemblance to the hotel in The Shining, creepily historical Hotel Pennsylvania. Done with my talk, I was ready to soak up the conference's truly extraordinary, politically charged atmosphere of drama, intrigue, and suspense. The charged mood at HOPE wasn't the result of Anonymous. At the time, while Anonymous could already be described as politically quirky, the group was, geopolitically speaking, of little real significance. Anonymous activists had started to engage in other arenas, like Iran's Green Revolution, but were still primarily focused on Chanology, doggedly exposing Scientology's human rights abuses and protesting every month in cities across North America, Australia, Europe, and a few other countries. A sizable number of trolls still claimed the Anonymous moniker, but this stream of ultra-coordinated motherfuckery was clearly on the wane. No, the intrigue saturating the conference was due to another player in town, the whistleblowing sensation WikiLeaks. More specifically, interest coalesced around the recent trove of documents and footage leaked by a young army private named Chelsea Manning, formerly Bradley Manning, and laid at the feet of the world by WikiLeaks. Founded in 2006, the driving concept behind WikiLeaks had been simple: provide both a safe house and a clearinghouse for leaks. It had been at it for years, circulating countless leaks, but failing to draw significant attention from established media institutions like the New York Times. This lack of attention was not due to unworthiness. In fact, some of these leaks, like the news that the multinational company Trafigura had illegally dumped toxic waste off the Ivory Coast, were both shocking and shockingly absent from the mainstream news media. It also wasn't for want of trying, at least not exclusively. The British government gagged the left-leaning newspaper The Guardian from covering the Trafigura story. As the editors noted at the time, The Guardian is also forbidden from telling its readers why the paper is prevented, for the first time in memory, from reporting Parliament. Legal obstacles which cannot be identified involve proceedings which cannot be mentioned on behalf of a client who must remain secret. And so, by April 2010, WikiLeaks had dramatically switched public relations strategies. When they released video footage of a Baghdad airstrike under the title Collateral Murder, WikiLeaks left nothing to chance, packaging the already shocking material in a way that delivered an extra punch. They edited the video for maximum effect and added simple but powerful editorial commentary at the beginning. Julian Assange, the Australian hacker who founded WikiLeaks, was then known in the media as an international man of mystery. Now he broke with his previous disavowal of the spotlight. To coincide with the publication of the video, he hosted a press conference in Washington, D.C., and followed it with a high-profile media tour. The journalistic and public response was nothing short of explosive. Media scholar Christian Christensen argues the video is one of the best known and most widely recognized results of the ongoing WikiLeaks project because it provides visual evidence of the gross abuse of state and military power. The black and white footage is captured from the perspective of a soldier in an Apache attack helicopter as he mows down civilians in a Baghdad suburb. The video, shot in 2007, provoked questions. Why had we not seen the footage earlier? Two of the men killed in the attack were journalists working for the Reuters news service, and the organization had been trying, in the years since the attack, to get its hands on the footage via a Freedom of Information Act request. They suspected foul play, and their suspicions were not unfounded. The video was an embarrassing reminder of how the mainstream media had failed in its mission to inform the public by turning its back on the direct and gruesome style of war reportage it had practiced in the final years of the Vietnam War. More than anything, though, it was the pilots' banal tone of voice during their discussions with command about whether to attack. They were calm to the point of psychosis that really sent waves of horror over you. One member of the crew laughs upon discovering that one of the victims is a young girl. "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids to a battle," he remarks nonchalantly. As we all now know, Chelsea Manning chose to leak the video, along with other vital documents, and a hacker named Adrian Lamo ratted her out. On May 22, 2010, Manning confessed to Lamo during a chat conversation that she'd gifted WikiLeaks the footage that was used to create collateral murder. Early in the conversation, Lamo earned Manning's trust by misrepresenting himself. "I'm a journalist and a minister. You can pick either and treat this as a confession or an interview, never to be published, and enjoy a modicum of legal protection." Manning subsequently spilled her guts to a person she had never met and whose claims of being a journalist and a priest were tenuous at best. Lamo turned the log over to both the FBI and Wired magazine. The FBI arrested Manning, ultimately leading to her admission that she had provided WikiLeaks with not only the video footage seen in collateral murder, but also the diplomatic cables WikiLeaks would release over the next 2 years. Manning was sentenced by a military judge to 35 years in prison and is now at Fort Leavenworth, following a year in solitary confinement before being sentenced. At the 2010 Hope Conference, there was palpable tension in the air. Rumors swirled that Julian Assange was going to give the keynote. In a last-minute switch-up, it was not Assange who stepped out on stage, but American hacker Jacob Applebaum. His riveting talk effectively outed him, in front of everyone in attendance, including the inevitable federal agents, as an affiliate of the embattled organization. It was a bold move, given the tactics of silencing, prosecution, and intimidation leveled against the organization by U.S. authorities. His talk contextualized WikiLeaks historically into what is now commonly called the Fifth Estate, the hackers, leakers, independent journalists, and bloggers who serve the critical role that once fell to the Fourth Estate, the mainstream media. Or, as Applebaum put it, "When the media is gagged, we refuse to be gagged. We refuse to be silent." A declaration that was met with thunderous applause. The most glaring example of media silence in the past decade was when the New York Times refused, at the request of the government, to publish a story on the NSA's illegal, warrantless wiretaps. The Times eventually ran the story, only because the author, James Risen, was about to scoop the paper by publishing a book on the topic. The article, which they tried so hard to withhold, ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize. While WikiLeaks, collateral murder, and Manning had found pride of place in talks among politically minded hackers and transparency advocates, a fourth figure dominated most conversations at Hope: Lamo, the hacker traitor. He was on the tip of every tongue for one simple reason. He was, like them, a hacker himself, and present at the conference, no less. People were completely pissed off. Applebaum, during his talk on WikiLeaks, promised not to utter a word about Lamo. As he said this, he unbuttoned his shirt to reveal a T-shirt that said, "Stop snitching." The crowd went wild. Flyers bearing Lamo's face subsequently popped up throughout the venue. Lamo was wanted, dead or alive, for being a low-down, good-for-nothing rat bastard. As I stood staring at the flyer, a hacker friend of mine darted up from behind me to say hello. Shaking his head in Lamo-evoked disgust, my friend explained that Assange was the real deal, rare high praise from a fellow hacker. He had known him back in the 1990s when the hacker underground was in full force and roaming free, before the crackdowns against them in the late 1990s. This class of hacker would routinely disregard the law in his or her explorations of private networks and computer systems, not motivated by profit or malice, but instead by an insatiable curiosity, a desire to know how things worked. While the transgression itself offered a form of pleasure, back then only a small class of hackers was explicitly inclined toward activist-oriented politics. Julian Assange was one of them. He was a thoroughly conscientious hacker who even penned ethical manifestos explaining his actions. Assange was part of a small team of international subversives who abided by a creed: don't damage computer systems you break into, including crashing them. Don't change the information in those systems, except for altering logs to cover your tracks, and share information. Wrapping up our discussion on Assange, my friend and I heard some exciting news. Hope's main organizer, Eric Corley, better known by his famous hacker handle Emmanuel Goldstein, had announced an impromptu panel on snitching and snitches, featuring none other than Lamo. Lamo was slated to sit alongside some of the most famous underground phone freaks and hackers of all time: Bernie S., Mark Abeen, a.k.a. Fiber Optic, and Kevin Mitnick. A couple had served jail time as the result of snitching. They themselves, in their own trials and travails, had all refused to cooperate, paying dearly with extended jail time for staying silent and not ratting out their peers. In all my years of attending hacker conferences, this panel remains the most extraordinary I have witnessed. Imagine 2,600 hackers sitting before a single despised traitor as he looks out at them from the stage and attempts to justify his actions. Hacker Town Hall on Snitching, with the most reviled hacker snitch of all time. The hackers opened the panel by recounting riveting stories of their exploits, eventual capture, and betrayal at the hands of trusted peers. The first to speak was Goldstein, who highlighted a truism I would see in action a little later with Anonymous. When cops or feds show up, usually at daybreak and knocking loudly while pointing guns, Goldstein reminded the audience, people panic, and the authorities count on this. The authorities live for this kind of thing so that they get as much information. They get all of us telling other people about other people. When Lamo climbed on stage and ambled slowly toward his chair, well, the circles under his eyes were deep brown, and when he blinked, it was done in slow motion and with great difficulty, as if he had to force his eyelids down each time. It wasn't that he seemed nervous. He just seemed genuinely zonked. It is quite possible that he was, along with being very tired, also medicated. Lamo had once been lauded as a black hat hacker, and listening to him justify his actions was spellbinding. He felt compelled, he explained, to hand over the logs in the interest of national defense. Bernie S., wanting details, respectfully interrupted, in what way did you feel people were put at risk? Lamo gave a rambling response. The State Department is involved in a number of intelligence operations throughout the world. They are not supposed to be, but they are looking out for the interests of Americans. This triggered immediate hisses from the crowd, and an audience member yelled, "The State Department activities put other people at risk." Goldstein sensed the crowd might turn into a lynch mob, sharpening their pitchforks and lighting their torches, ready to run Lamo out of town. He calmed the audience down, reminding them, you will have your say, but not before Fiber Optic first chortled, we will be handing out darts and bows and arrows, so don't worry. The comic relief released some steam, but the tense atmosphere simply returned until the end. Time and again, Lamo's attempts to rationalize his actions were met with angry boos. After Lamo defended the government and described his interactions with its agents as a surprisingly pleasant undertaking, even Goldstein couldn't help himself. He interrupted Lamo before the Q&A period to ask how he felt about the possibility that Manning might spend the rest of her life in jail. Someone in the crowd also lobbed out torture. Without missing a beat, Lamo intonated slowly, "We don't do that to our citizens." Some of the loudest hisses and boos of the day rustled through the audience, and someone yelled Guantanamo. No matter what Lamo said, it was apparent that he was digging himself into a deeper hole, and it was also apparent that nearly the entire auditorium was ready to fill in the dirt on top of him. At the time, however engrossing the panel was, I could not see its relevance to my project on Anonymous. WikiLeaks and Anonymous were, back then, residing on different planets. Even if they were, admittedly, part of the same geeky galaxy by way of their respective fights against censorship and Scientology. And yet, 1 year after the conference, on July 4th, 2011, I had my very first private IRC chat with Anonymous's most famous snitch, Hector Monsieger, who had previously been known only as Sabu. By then, he had already been arrested and was secretly working with the FBI, though this fact was lost both on myself and many others at the time, in spite of a litany of now obvious clues. Monsieger's charisma and his adeptness in psychological warfare tactics, like displacing suspicion by accusing others of snitching, blinded many to the hints he dropped in plain text a few months after his covert arrest. Stick to yourself.